for compassion. From stress, from stress management to ethics, motivation, and conflict resolution. So this is what I intend to discuss today. And you may ask any question, and I would be very happy to explore them, to explore those questions as well. Now, first, the main title has two parts. One is mindfulness, the second one is compassion. So we have to work on mindfulness first. Mindfulness is the attention training. We train the mind to pay attention. The quality of our work, I should say also the quality of our life, depends on the quality of our attention. I have hot water here. How much this hot water is worth? Usually people would put, they would put a figure on this. A figure on this. Wow, this is worth maybe $400, just maybe $500, just maybe $1,000, just maybe $1, maybe $2. If you go to Harrods, maybe maybe $10, maybe $10. That's a figure. That's a figure. That doesn't tell you, okay, the quality of this hot water. What about this water, this glass of water? It's the same. So very often we mistake the quality of life with a number, with a figure. Worse than that, very often we mistake happiness with a figure. We also mistake success with a figure. But you can put a figure on anything. You can buy a figure with another figure. You can increase a figure with another figure. These are all, I mean, I don't have to tell you, I should learn from you. You should be here telling me, okay, with all the MBA that you have done. What I'm telling is that my attention, first is that I pay attention that, okay, a glass of water is in my hand. Secondly, I pay attention to the need of my body, deep-seated need. That's okay, without this water, my physical body will get dehydrated. So constantly I need water. The same to you. Then this water, no, we don't. Well, so we don't have a well, maybe we have, but maybe we don't use it here in the PQ Club. You know, this water comes from elsewhere. Comes from elsewhere. This water, before it comes into this glass and be placed just next to me, it has passed many hands. In other words, many good hearts. So that this water is purifying and safe enough for me to drink whenever I need it. It involves, okay, engineers, managers, planners, investors, many things, directly, indirectly. So if I pay attention to that process, this water is actually worth a lot more. You cannot put figure on this water anymore. And this is what we say mindfulness. So mindfulness is the art of paying attention. I just want you to remember this word. The art of paying attention. If you are eating, if you are paying attention to the food you eat, and not just the food being on the table, but before it came to the table, a lot of people have put their effort into that, so that when you need food, it's easily available on the table. With this, the quality of your food is no longer determined by the figure. The figure that a restaurant charges you. If you allow, your attention to stop at the figure, the value of your life, the value of your food stop at the figure. So it's very important not to confuse figure with life, and not to confuse figure with success, not to confuse figure with happiness. Mindfulness. And in Burmese, we call it the Dipaten. The D is mindfulness. Paten means based. Mindfulness based something. Compassion is based on mindfulness. Happiness is based on mindfulness. Peace is based on mindfulness. So the Dipaten is the foundation of many things. Foundation of many things. Before I offer you some instruction how we develop mindfulness, I want to show you a video clip from Yale University, or Hindu Ramway, from Yale University. Maybe you can switch off this life. Do you know the people? Do you this video clip is from a 6.5 minutes lecture given at Davos at World Economic Forum. It's about mindfulness. Let's have a look at it.
Capupuli. Lot of what's happening to us. One study showed that our minds are actually
that suggests being mindful in itself might make you happier. And it leaves you a lot more time and energy to act wisely and make good decisions. That means that being mindful allows you to respond to the world rather than reactions. And how does mindfulness do that? Well, one way it does it is by altering the brain's defaults. That is the default mode network. You can think of it as an autopilot. It's a network of regions that's more active when our mind is continuously wandering and less active when we're focused on a task. And to test whether mindfulness meditation alters these defaults, we recruited experienced mindfulness meditators, not Buddhist monks, but healthy Western adults who just have to meditate, kind of like me. And we then scanned their brains using fMRI and compared their brain activity to the brain activity of well-matched control who've never meditated. What we found is that experienced meditators actually report a significant lower amount of mind wandering and less activity and connectivity in their default mode network. Does it mean that you all need to practice many years to change your defaults? Apparently not. Much less training already starts changing your defaults. In one study, stressed adults were recruited and randomized to have two conditions, made either an intensive mindfulness training for 3 days or 3 days of a control training. The results showed that even after 3 days of intensive mindfulness training, there were already some similar changes to the default mode network that were similar to what we saw with the experienced meditators. In addition, those who meditated also showed a reduction in an inflammation marker that is related to diseases. In comparison, those who did the control training actually showed an increase in this inflammation marker. In addition, the default mode network actually was responsible for some of the reduction in inflammation. This suggests that mindfulness training changes your brain, it changes your emotional experience, and it changes your body in a way that makes you more resilient to stress and disease. And there's even more good news here. You might start noticing some of the benefits of mindfulness meditation as soon as the first time that you try. We tested this in a few recent studies. We recruited individuals who never meditated, and we randomized them to either meditate for 10 minutes for the first time or do a control activity for 10 minutes. We then tested their performance on a task that required both accuracy and speed. What we found is that those individuals who meditated for the first time overall were faster or more accurate than those who didn't meditate. And we also saw changes in brain activity that suggested that their brains were more attuned to the task, allowing them to perform better. What this means is that in the time that it might take you to just briefly check your email, you might try to meditate for 10 minutes, and you might have an improvement in your cognitive performance. So in conclusion, I invite you to ask yourself, do I want to be more focused? Do I want to be more present? Do I want to have more time and energy to act wisely and make a decision? If you answer yes to any of these questions, you might want to try mindfulness meditation. Now, mindfulness is not for everyone, and it's not a panacea, but we know that it can fundamentally alter your brain's defaults. We know that it can reduce your stress and make you more focused. And importantly, it can allow you to live in this moment, accepting it exactly as it is, maybe even loving it exactly as it is, even if shit happens. Thank you very much.
So what do? We have to change our brain default. What's our brain default? Our brain default is hooked. It's hooked to what they call negativity bias. Negativity bias as it's hooked to negativity bias. We are biased towards negativity. We remember more negative things than the positive. In a day, if you have 10 experiences, 5 of them are positive, 4 of them neutral, 1 negative. At the end of the day, you will remember only the negative one. This is called negativity bias. Thank you. I'm not sure if you can see from behind. Three kinds of models, three kinds of focus. It's from Professor Paul Gilbert from Derby University. This book quotes it, this book cites it, Compassion Focus Therapy. You have in this as well. This is called threat focus. You only focus on threat, on danger, on negative things, on what might go wrong. Threat focus. When you do this, you release adrenaline in your body, the hormone, even before cortisol. These are all stress hormones. Okay. The more you focus on threat, the more you produce these hormones. If you produce this hormone, the video clip refers to the brain region called amygdala. That's the brain default. Most people, our brain is here. This is the default mode. So we need to change this. In the Stone Age, human being, we need to fear. We need to fear animals. You know, they outnumber human being 1,000 times, maybe more than that. But today, we don't really need to fear animals anymore. And we live in a relatively safe environment. But the thing is that, although we don't have wild animals surrounding us, this brain default, which is negatively biased or fight and flight mode, this one, this brain is still active. So when you come from home to reach here, if you are in a traffic jam, you go into this mode straight away. I had to be meditating all the way so that I don't go into the threat focus. The second one is incentive focus. Incentive focus. You might teach your kids, okay, if you work hard, if you pass this exam, I'm going to give you this one. So incentive focus. You know, this is reward focus. The problem with this is that you create want, you create desire in your kids. They want it, they work hard, they achieve it, they consume it, and they want it again, and they work for it again, they get it again, and they consume it again. So they become a consumerism machine out of habit. Not that they enjoy what they consume, but they have to consume simply because they have that habit. The hormone produced here is called dopamine. The top one is called affiliative focus. We feel affiliated, we feel connected. And this is where compassion comes from. If I feel affiliated to you, if I feel connected to you, I feel very safe here. Threat focus, this focus is actually looking for safety. But it doesn't get safety. Why? Because it only focuses on threat. Once you see a person as a threat, you no longer relate to this person in a positive way. Instead, you see this person in a negative light. You know? You feel threatened by this person. When you feel threatened by this person, you may be putting everything in your power, okay, to achieve safety, but inside your heart, you won't feel safe. This one, by connecting with people, by connecting with their pain, with their joy, with their effort, with their aspiration, with their disappointment, you feel connected with them. A sense of connection between you and those people. This is called a relation. It's like the mother and her son. Okay? How well they are connected. They don't have to talk. When a child is 1 year old, 2 years old, 3 years old, the child doesn't know how to talk and doesn't understand their own experience. But the connection that the mother and the child has is very strong. It's called affiliated focus. If the mother is upset, the child can feel that. If the child experiences some tension, and the mother can feel it. That hormone is called oxytocin. For people who have medical knowledge, this is a very important oxytocin. With oxytocin, you feel safe. You feel safe with the people you are with. So here, changing the brain default means changing from here to there. In the Burmese Buddhist psychology, this is called Bodha. This is called Karuna. This is agudo, agudose. This is kudose. Agudose means unskillful mind, unskillful emotion, unskillful thought. Kudo means skillful thought. Skillful thought, wholesome thought. So how do we do that? Attention training, very simple, very simple. Earlier, Dr. Hedy Kolber from Yale University, she suggested that we pay attention to breathing. And we also pay attention to our thought, to our emotion, without fighting them, and without suppressing them. Remember these two words, without fighting them and without suppressing them. Instead, what do we have to do? Number one is attention, we pay attention to. Number two, attitude. Attitude of acceptance. We accept, okay, these are automatic thoughts, we accept them. We don't blame ourselves for having those thoughts. Okay, and we don't run away from them, we don't ignore them. That's attitude, the attitude. In the meditation center, the usual instruction in Burmese would be Bora Limapa, a council between. That would be the instruction. So you just accept whatever appears in your mind. It may be a thought, it may be an emotion, like that. I think it's time to do some practice. Can I do a quick survey? Who have been to a meditation retreat? Okay, thank you. So this will help me to determine. We are going to meditate for 6 minutes. 6 minutes, it's not that long, okay? 6 minutes. But you better prepare. These 6 minutes, they may be the longest of your life. What you do when you breathe in, you can count your breathing if you like. You can count breathing in, you count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Slow and gentle breathing. Okay? Count. You need to relax your body. Relax your shoulders, relax your, the muscles around your head. Relax them. Okay, and also relax your lower part of your back, your lower back, relax them. Sit comfortably. Put your feet together, put your hands together. This is a sign of being composed. That as you breathe in, count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. As you breathe out, you can count 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Breathing in, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Breathing out, 5, 2, 3, 4, 1. Slow and gentle breathing. Slow and gentle breathing. You should expect that you will have a lot of automatic thought, habitual thought. Don't go into the contents. Just pay attention to the fact that they are automatic thought. They're habitual thought. Okay, this is habitual thought. I don't intend to think. It just happens. Automatic thought. You register that 2 or 3 times, this is automatic thought, this is automatic thought. And then you return to breathing. You return to counting your breath. Breathing in and out, in and out. If you experience any emotion, you can name it, name that emotion. Maybe curiosity, maybe anxiety about work, maybe fear, okay, maybe regret. Just name them. Don't judge them good or bad. Don't ever judge them. Then return to breathing. This way you get to know your emotion. You get to train attention. 6 minutes now. You can open your eyes. During the 6 minutes of mindfulness practice, you may have found that your mind was wandering all over the places. That's not the problem. That's not the main problem. The main problem, or rather the more interesting thing, is how you react to that, how you react to that wandering mind. Do you start judging yourself? I can't do it. Something like that. If you say, I can't do it, your habitual reaction is negative thinking, negative attitude. That negative attitude comes from your brain default, from the amygdala, and that's what you need to change. How to change it? By accepting, okay, this is an uncomfortable feeling. This is an uncomfortable feeling about the wandering mind. When the mind wanders, if you react negatively, you just accept that, you just know that reaction. You don't need to add anything into that. This is what we say, no value added judgment. No value added judgment. Just see it as is, just accept it as it is. Accept disappointment as disappointment. So if we accept this, we get to know ourselves, we get to know the default position better. We get to know that better. With that, with practice, it doesn't have to be very long. This book, The Science of Meditation, by Daniel Goleman, the author of Emotional Intelligence, and Professor Richard Davidson from Wisconsin University, who researches on meditation, the science of meditation, how to change your brain, mind, and body. They say 16 hours, 1 6-hour. Earlier, it says 3 days. 3 days usually is about 5 to 8 hours a day. So if 5 hours a day, so 15 hours. If 8 hours a day, according to standard meditation practice that we have in this country, 8 hours a day, then you're talking about 24 hours. After 24 hours of this practice, you will see that brain default starting to change. In 3 days, you can't do anything else. You can't learn anything else. Driving, not enough. IT, worse. MBA, you haven't even started in 3 days. But here, 3 days, you start changing your brain default knowledge. During the 6 minutes, when you see your mind wandering, if you judge automatically, it's very difficult to control the mind. I can't do it. If this thought ever enters your mind, that's habitual thinking. Take it as habitual thinking. It's something that you can change. The video clip that we have watched earlier is intended to give you that message, that you can change your own brain default. You can change your habitual thinking from negative into positive. If you remember the definition of attention given by Dr. Hedy Kobler, being open, being curious, being present. Being curious means when you see your mind wandering, if you're more curious about the mind, about yourself, this is called mindfulness. The mind doesn't have to be totally concentrated. Before we move on, is there any question? Do you have microphone, wireless microphone? Kit, can you? Do you have wireless microphone to ring? Microphone, Sheila, wireless microphone, Sheila. Make a major melody. Okay. So far from what I have explained, okay, is there any question, anyone who wishes some clarification? Okay. Mindful compassion. I'm just on the first part, mindfulness. I come to that compassion part, okay? Okay. On mindfulness, any other question? So if no more question, okay, here, yeah. Question. Curious kara, pomo lu, kara in tau ni ja, nyamas kara no sanda be, tichi ni sanda. Seika wandering pitas and the wandering mind of Bani Lars, early teacher. The curious pit. Early curious pit, to me, at the wandering mind at Patavia, open pit. You are open. Early Moho Bennett, the wandering mind is who like a judge load. You are judging yourself. A little judge load of camera, at the Dhamma teaching, you close yourself. Being open and being curious, these two are the same. Being present also means knowing what's happening at the present moment. If your mind is wandering, if you know that your mind is wandering, this is called mindfulness, the deepest. Okay. When do we start and how? When means, okay, since they were born, the day they were born. But mindfulness has to come from the mother and the father. No, you don't have to explain them, this is mindfulness. When you see your child is restless, the child is not asking for a toy. When she already has a toy, she's not asking for another one. She's asking for your attention, the mother's attention. At that moment, if you are with her, if you take her around, the most important thing is if she can touch you. She can touch you. she will grow up a very focused person. Instead, there are parents who panic, I should say, maybe the word is very strong, who panic when the child becomes restless. So they start giving the child this, when the child is not interested, another one. We don't really know if that's what the child wants or if the child needs. But we just want to shut them up. Stop crying. Look, take interest. Okay, take interest in this toy. We are forcing them to associate with these toys. In Belgrade, a professor and his wife both are full-time working at a university. They brought their 6 years old and 3 years old to me. Their 6 years old, one day, he told his dad, "Daddy, you never buy me a toy." This professor was very shocked, more than shocked. Actually, he was embarrassed, he was maybe agitated with his son. "Look, I just bought you yesterday. Look at my credit card, look at the receipt." Look at the receipt. The child doesn't understand that. And he asked me, "How can a 6 years old lying? You know, how can he be lying at six?" I told him, "You are a scientist, professor, okay? I'm a Buddhist monk. Your child is not lying. He's making a statement. He's saying that, 'Daddy, whatever you give me, they don't belong to me. I don't feel they belong to me. Because I have no time to make friends with them, to associate with them. Before I know this one, you already bring me a new one. Before I knew this, I know the second one, you already bring me the third one. Now I have a big burden of deciding which one is mine.'" The child is making that statement. So I was telling that professor, "You need to read between the lines. He's saying the truth. That truth, you need to read psychologically. It's likely that he's the first child. It's likely that he's the first of the grandparents, the first grandchild. So everybody showers him with a lot of present. So he has no time, okay, to develop a relationship with any of his toys. So he feels that he hasn't got any. His father and his mother, maybe the whole family, they never stop giving him. But he never feels he has received anything. You see? Parents have to be more mindful. What the child is asking is attention, warmth, okay, attention, and reassurance. Sometimes when they look around, they see a lot of strange faces. They need reassurance. They need their mother, their father to be with them. So just by being with them, you pet them, and okay, you talk to them. How long would that take? Maybe a minute, maybe 2 minutes. They feel reassured and they go up playing. Okay. In playing, okay, they are learning many things. They are learning coordination. They are learning how to explore and appreciate nature, appreciate people. Like that. That's all part of mindfulness. Mindfulness for a child, it doesn't have to be sitting, closing your eyes and counting your breath. It's not that. This is one thing. Another thing you can teach your child is that you play the same music. You may play many other music, but choose one music, calming music, and play that maybe at some point during the day or maybe before bed, after you have read them a story. If they keep hearing the same music, maybe 3 minutes, maybe 4 minutes, calming music, that will go into their subconscious mind. That we have to calm them. That will be part of their mindfulness practice. But if the mother, themselves, okay, they want to keep changing the music, the melody, the you know, the lyrics, and now restlessness is not with the child, it's with the mother, and the child will pick that up. I want you to try on YouTube, okay, mindfulness for kids. They start very early at a nursery. And in England now, about 400 schools, they teach mindfulness. They have found that 80% of misbehaviors are reduced, 80%. Meaning everybody is well behaved. And over time, in a year or 2 years' time, the academic performance is getting better, and the gap between them and the non-mindfulness school, you know, is getting bigger. People have taken this to America and to Canada, So this is called mindfulness in school, MISP, mindfulness in school project, MISP. You can easily search for that. The way they teach kids how to accept their thought. Now, I ask you to accept, to register your thought, to let go, to register, to let go. But the way they teach kids is that, okay, imagine you are in a garden, a lot of flowers, a lot of butterflies, and there's a stream. And if you have a lot of thought, a lot of scary thought, just put all your thought in a small boat in the river. A small boat in the river, and let them go. Let your thought, okay, flow with the river, meaning to let your thought go. Many ways of, okay, teaching kids mindfulness. Okay. Any more question on mindfulness? If no, we can move to compassion. Okay. At the back.
Shabira, now 6 minutes meditation don't get you wrong. Shabira, my not bother to get you wrong. Your reaction she gets wrong. If you don't ask, I'll be wrong. My not bother to get you wrong. So I have a bother to get you wrong. So you know, actually don't fight. So the first half of my wandering is actually the second half of my time. Well, actually, I'm loving it, so I have to go. I'm not just letting it go and my home is one of the child, I'm not supposed to go. I'm going to be a child. Register your thought on the top three of the rise, but I agree when I'm at home, and three when it's over my own.
There are two ways of managing this wandering mind. One is the way you do. You just focus your attention on something else, and you put more effort into that. This is called concentration-based. And the one we are talking here is called mindfulness-based. This mindfulness-based, we are developing acceptance. Acceptance. If we don't do this, when we feel uncomfortable with our wandering mind, what does it mean, feeling uncomfortable? It means dislike. That feeling of dislike can be transferred to something else, to food, to clothes, to interaction with people, like that. That is why when we discover our mind wandering, we're trying to see what the mind is doing, how subconsciously we tend to react to that wandering mind. And these are all knowledge, these are all experiential knowledge. Experiential knowledge. What you need to observe, one thing here is a dislike towards wandering mind, or feeling tense, feeling uneasy towards wandering mind. If you recognize that, then feeling tense towards anything you don't like will reduce. With that, you will start enjoying many things a lot more than before. Before we can change our thinking habit, our emotional habit, we need to know what is it. So this is about getting to know what is it. That the mind just start thinking automatically without us, okay, making any effort. So this is a very interesting experience for human beings, because animals, people think they don't have thinking faculty. We need to work with our thinking faculty, thinking capacity. I think we should move on to compassion. If you can switch off this light. Now, this one is from a professor from Stanford University, who is a neurosurgeon. Okay, he came from a disadvantaged background. His father was an alcoholic, his mother was paralyzed, and none of the family member has been to college. But something changed his life when he was about 12 or 13. He went into a magic shop. He has written a well-known book, a famous book, Into a Magic Shop. That's the title of his book. And he went into that during the summer holiday. At that time, he had already developed negative thinking and he saw no opportunity in his life. A lot of negative thinking as a result, negative engagement, also negative activities. But going into that negative shop changed his life. The owner of the shop was not there, but his mother was there. And his mother started talking to him, giving him attention. And he started feeling the warmth and love from this lady. And that lady constantly giving him cookies. And the lady said, "I don't know how to sell these magic things. But if you keep coming to this shop for 6 weeks during the summer, I can teach you something that will change your life." And you can see now, he's a professor at Stanford University. He set up a center for compassion and altruism. And he's a very successful entrepreneur. Okay, so we listen to him.
Thank you. chronically depressed. In fact, she attempted suicide numerous times. We were evicted from our home multiple times. And you probably appreciate that when we grow up in an environment like that, what do you think the likelihood of overcoming that situation is? Probably pretty low. And in fact, we now have something called ACEs. Have you heard of that? Adverse Childhood Experiences? It's this rating system, so that if you have poverty in your life as a child, if you have stress, if you have anxiety, if you have alcoholism, if you have violence, if you have mental illness, the likelihood of you being a success in life diminishes with each of those. But something changed for me. And what changed for me was that I walked into a magic shop. And what happened in that magic shop to this 12-year-old kid who was suffering, who felt he had no future, no possibilities, and an immense amount of anger, who felt hopeless, did not feel loved, was that there was a person who, when I walked in, looked up from her book that she was reading, looked at me directly in my eyes, had a radiant smile which embraced me. And what it did was it made me feel safe. When you feel safe, when you feel accepted, when you feel loved, everything changes. It takes you from darkness to light. It takes you from seeing nothing and darkness to seeing infinite possibilities. And this woman looked at me, and after about 15 or 20 minutes of conversation, she said to me, "You know, I really like you. If you come here every day for the next 6 weeks I'm going to be here this summer, I'll teach you something that I think can change your life." And I did show up. And it wasn't because I had insight or self-awareness. Frankly, it was because she was feeding me cookies during our conversation. And I showed up. And what she made me realize was that I had created a prison for myself. When you come from an environment that I came from, you don't know what is going to happen next to you. Life is chaotic, and your life is fear. And what this woman taught me over this period of 6 weeks was that I could change my mind. I believed that nothing was possible. I believed I wasn't good enough. I believed I wasn't smart enough. I believed that there were no possibilities for me. And through this period of time with this woman, she made me realize that every time I had that negative statement about myself, it was as if I was laying a brick down, creating a prison for myself. And that prison kept getting smaller, it kept getting darker, and the possibilities diminished. And after spending a period of time with this woman where she taught me to relax, if you will, to meditate, to take this inward journey where I could have peace within myself and release that fear and believe that anything was possible, suddenly, I went from fear and self-loathing and shame to one of love. And what happened is that I realized that I had my own suffering, but I also realize now that I can say it was okay, that I was okay, that I was worthy of love, that I saw infinite possibilities, but I also saw that everyone suffered. And it's within that place of suffering that people do things that don't help them, and they don't help others. And in fact, I talk about each of us have wounds of the heart. Each of us have some events that have made us suffer. And for most of us, they heal. But I would suggest to you that every major calamity that is facing our species is a manifestation of people who have deep wounds in their hearts that have not healed. And it's within this that we have people who hurt others because they are hurting. It's with this environment where there is darkness and you cannot see light. I just spent the last decade understanding how the brain works to give me insights into why people fear and not love. And what's extraordinary is, as a species, we have been designed to tear into love. But what happens is that when environments are created that stimulate a part of our nervous system called the sympathetic nervous system, this flight or fight response, negative physiologic things happen. And negative things happen in your brain. Those parts of your brain that are thoughtful, that are discerning, that allow you to make good decisions, actually are shut down. When you are scared or frightened, you have the release of hormones, you have the release of cortisol, you have the release of interleukin 6, you have the release of inflammatory proteins, all of these that have negative physiologic effect. But the thing is that you can change that, and that's what this woman taught me. Once you have insight, once you have self-awareness, everything can change. And the part of our physiology, the part of our nervous system that actually takes us out of this fear mode and shifts us from our sympathetic nervous system, which is part of our nervous system, which is part of the vagus nerve, is the parasympathetic nervous system. And this is the rest and digest system, it's called. And you know what happens when you can live there? Now, part of our brain problem, our executive control function, works at its best. You're more discerning. You're able to take memories of good experiences. You're able to make thoughtful decisions. You're not making rash decisions to survive. Your physiology actually works at its best. And it is in this place that you are meant to be. It is in this place that you can be anytime. It is available to you, and this is the place that gives you your power. And this is what this woman taught me. Because everyone in this room has an immense amount of power within them. But it is often this negative narrative about themselves. Sometimes they feel like they have this imposter syndrome, and it limits us. What this woman did for me, and what each of us can give to another, is an openness, an acceptance, and an unconditional love. Because when you give that, that changes not only them, but the reward centers, the pleasure centers, are stimulated. There's the release of what's called oxytocin, which is the nurturing or love hormone, which gives you this warm feeling when you connect. when you're kind. And I talked about an inward journey. I did have this inward journey because, as Gandhi said, you cannot have peace in the world until you have peace within. Having spent time understanding how to give myself peace, which is through love, it has now allowed me to see the world with love. As you see in this little drawing, which I did not do, you can see the head voice and you can see the heart voice. And if you look at the title of my book, it's called Into the Magic Jug, A Neurosurgeon's Quest to Discover the Mysteries of the Brain and the Secrets of the Heart. Because when you stimulate that vagus nerve and engage your parasympathetic nervous system, that is when you have transcendence. That is when you have meaning in life. Because you've left internal place where oftentimes you ruminate and you talk about how bad things are, you talk about how negative things are within your mind, and it's when you are of service to others, when you care, that everything becomes possible. You know, this feeling of transcendence, this feeling of contentment, this feeling that you have meaning in your life, it is only through this outward journey that that is possible. It's interesting, as our other speaker was saying, we have an epidemic of sadness, anxiety, depression, loneliness. Yet we have amazing tools of science and technology. And I would suggest to you that those tools can go one of two ways. They can result in a profound effect on the human landscape and take us to the deepest, darkest valleys of human suffering. Or they will take us potentially to the highest peaks of human potential. And the determinant of which direction that goes is by compassion through love. Because it is through love that darkness is vanquished, it is through love that fear dissipates. It is through love that we reach our true potential. And when we look at the world through that lens, what happens? We no longer see our family as our brother, our sister, our mother, our father. We see that every human is part of our family. We don't see our home as the place that we live. We see the world as our home. And it is through compassion that transcendence occurs, and it is through compassion that we are able to reach that far shore where we look and we recognize the other as our brother, as our sister, and as where we see that the world is our home, and we find that there are no longer barriers that separate us, but powerful forces that bind us. And you see that, when that possibility manifests, then we shift from the term, this is America, as not even a negative term, but a positive term of how we can all make the world a better place for everyone. person, because what you do for the other is what you do for yourself. I mentioned that sometimes we think we cannot do anything. But look, we already see this young lady. And look what she has done. Sitting out by herself in August of 2018. And what has this person done? She has mobilized the world. Because she recognizes that we are all in this together, that there is no planet B, and that what happens to someone across that far shore ultimately will affect us. And I would like to close with this statement by Margaret Mead and tell you that never forget the power each of you has when you walk in this world with love and not fear. Thank
you. This is an introduction to compassion, and through his own life story, compassion has transformed his life. He's a neurosurgeon, a professor at Harvard, at Stanford University, and who has set up a center for compassion and Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. It's called CCARE, C-C-A-R-E, at Stanford University School of Medicine. I want to tell you how he argued about the importance of compassion from a scientific point of view. Usually we quote Charles Darwin, the survival of the fittest theory. The fittest person, the fittest species will survive. That means you need to make yourself fit and you don't really need to care for the weak. According to this book, Oxford Handbook of Compassion Science. This is from Oxford's Compassion Science. This is how science is studied scientifically. And in this preface is written by this Professor James Doty. He argued that Charles Darwin view is that compassion matters. Compassion is important. Only communities with compassion means they look after each other. Only the community with most people, with most compassionate people, only that community will flourish. He quotes Charles Darwin again. In Darwin's later published Descent of Man in 1871, he wrote, I quote, "Those communities which included the greatest number of the most sympathetic members would flourish best, and bear the greatest number of offspring." End quote. Darwin further states, I quote, "We are empowered to relieve the suffering of another in order that our painful suffering may be at the same time relieved." Professor James Doty has written here, he said, what has become evident and what Kant, this is Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher, and Darwin, Charles Darwin, Kropotkin, this is a Russian scientist, allude to is that compassion characterized by nurturing and caring behavior is critical to the long-term survival of many species, and most importantly, perhaps, to the human species. Here in Myanmar, if we are to survive as a nation, as a country, as people, we need compassion. So over time, it was evident that such practices had the potential to promote what is at the center of Buddhist philosophy and that of most of the world religions, the cultivation of compassion. The science has further evidenced that such cultivation can have profound positive effects on one's physiology. Additionally, as a physician, I have personally experienced the profound effect that compassion care can have on the healing process. So I'm trying to convince you about the merit of compassion. That by taking in compassion, by thinking compassionately, not to use it when other forces fail, but to use compassion from the outset. From the outset, in your planning, in your worldview, you have nothing to lose and you have everything to gain. I'll be showing you two more video clips today from a professor who specializes in intensive medicine, another one who is a social care workers. So, to start with, what compassion is. Compassion is which word should I use? Sympathy or empathy? So we say compassion is about the recognition of other people's suffering with authentic desire to relieve it. So compassion always comes with action. I want you to note this point. There are three words. One, the lowest one is sympathy. In the latter is empathy. The top one is compassion. Sympathy is only understanding. I understand how you feel, and I understand this is a difficult time, that much. This is sympathy. Empathy is feeling. Sympathy is understanding. Empathy is feeling. You feel the pain of that person. This requires mindfulness. Mindfulness of that pain. Mindfulness of that pain. Then, in English, we say we are moved by someone's pain. We are moved. When you use the word move, being moved, this is empathy. It took me a long time to work this out. I have a student who comes to meditate with me for the last 4 years at Oxford. And he's a philosophy student, a doctoral student, and his thesis is on empathy. He specializes on empathy and ethics. Then you feel moved by people's suffering. That motivates you to take some action. And that becomes compassion. Compassion is about problem solving. Okay, I know how you feel, you know. That kind of warm word, it's not yet compassion, it's only sympathy. It's only sympathy. We exchange sympathy with other people. I mean, in Burmese we say, Kuchinsa. The word Kuchinsa, you know, you put yourself in other people's place. This can mean sympathy, this can mean empathy, this can also mean compassion. It depends on the level of that person. Kuchinsa. So Kuchinsa, the word Kuchinsa means put yourself in their shoes. That kind of expression. Put yourself in their shoes. Is it sympathy? Is it empathy? Is it compassion? It can be anything. Depends on your mindfulness level, your state of mind. It can be anything. Basically, compassion focuses on pain, on problem. The world has a lot of problems. From America to China, from India to South Africa, you know, including us, you know, we have problems. But this problem, when people talk about problem, usually the temper flares up. They cannot control their anger. If that happens, they miss the opportunity to do great things, to solve problems. You know, people are deeply affected by problems. Between siblings, between neighbors, whenever there is a problem, people either blame other people or they blame themselves. That doesn't work. So mindfulness is about being aware of our reaction, our habitual reaction, and trying to regulate them. Only with that emotional regulation, we can start cultivating compassion. I think this morning we may stop here for lunch break. So one time we should start maybe 12:30, is that okay? Okay, we can start at 12:30. In the afternoon, I should warn you, there will be a lot of meditation practice. Oh. Okay, that'd be correct, huh? That'd be correct.